I just had the opportunity to visit the other services, or some of them. Some I went to last night, some just now, and it reminded me how in one very deep way, I don't really want to give this sermon, because once I do, if past experience is any guide, half the place is going to clear out. And I so like having you all here that I feel as though next year we should say the sermon is going to be around 12, 1 o'clock and really save it to like 7 and see if the strategy works. I promised you last night a joke. But before I get to the joke, as long as I'm talking about the sermon without actually giving it yet, let me say one more thing that's about the sermon but isn't. That I want to clarify, I don't usually feel the need to comment on previous sermons, but today I do. I'm going to tell you in part a story that a couple of you have heard actually about giving the benediction at the Democratic National Committee earlier this year. And I want to say something about that and about the sermon on Rosh Hashanah. It is Yom Kippur. I would not lie in front of the congregation on Yom Kippur. Really. I don't endorse candidates. Not explicitly and not even by implication. That was never my intention, is not my intention, and will never be my intention. So if you assume that I was trying to tell you who to vote for, believe me, it was in your head but not in mine. I was trying to establish an agenda for whomever you do vote for, and that I will still do, and of course today, of all days on Yom Kippur, when someone whose name I would rather not mention from the Bima is speaking at the United Nations of all places, it should remind you how absolutely, incredibly, fundamentally urgent that issue is. The issue of Israel in this election, but who you think represents better our interests is not for me to imply or to state. And I really mean that. So if someone asks you if I endorse, you can say on Yom Kippur in front of the congregation, he told us he didn't. Please, take that seriously. Now, the sermon. You know, when you read a book, they have prologues and things. So that was the prologue to the sermon. The joke is the introduction to the sermon, and then the sermon. First, I want to give credit for the joke to Leo David, whom I called one of our wonderful treasured members, a staunch supporter of Israel, and I called him before the holidays, and he said, let me offer you a Yom Kippur joke. So I'm always in the market, by the way, you should just know, for Yom Kippur jokes. And this is his. About two Jews who were talking, and one of them said to the other, so you're going to fast on Yom Kippur? And the other one said, you know, I don't think so. Don't really see the point. I kept the Ten Commandments this year. I was good. I was nice to people. I behaved well. I didn't break any of the commandments. I observed the mitzvot. I don't see why I should fast. The guy goes, okay. And goes home and says to his wife, you won't believe it. I met someone today who's so foolish that he gives up sinning all year just so he doesn't have to fast on one day. So I hope none of you have been so foolish. God knows I haven't. Really, it's worth one day of discomfort. And that joke actually points to a really important point. And I want to say to you that I'm about to tell you something important, but earlier this year, I discovered that I shouldn't say that. Because I was driving my daughter to school, and I don't even remember what we were talking about, but I had the lack of wisdom to turn to her and say, Samara, you know how sometimes your dad says something and it's really memorable and important? And she said to me, not as often as he thinks. So I learned not to preface my remarks with "this is important." I'll tell you that it's important to me. And here is the question that is begged by the joke and by everything else, which is, we all know that we live in a very judgy world, a world, I don't want to say judgmental, but a world in which things are constantly judged. We're ranked, we're judged, thumbs up, thumbs down, lists, first, second, third. I'm not big on reality television, but I know that when someone comes on one of these shows where there's a panel of judges and they don't win, nobody says, "Oh, this is a wonderful person who just doesn't sing so well." You feel as though they're judged as human beings. They have lost. They are judged. And in fact, the cruelty with which they're judged makes the show more watchable, I am told. And so it seems to me, in some ways, on Yom Kippur, for all of us, the most important question that we can ask ourselves is, how do we judge ourselves and how should we judge ourselves? Let me start with the first and most obvious. We judge ourselves by appearance. We are an extraordinarily appearance-oriented society. Now, part of it is natural. There's no question about that. But a lot of it is us. You know that, I know that. How people appear throughout their lives is a constant source of comment. I read a wonderful article that I've tried to adhere to, but it's not easy, and the fact that it is not easy tells you what an issue this is. It says, when you see a little boy, you ask him what he's studying in school. When you see a little girl, you say, "You look pretty." Teaching a very important lesson to that little girl, which is, what counts? How you look. So now, there are befuddled and confused little girls all over Los Angeles who say, "The last time I saw the rabbi, he asked me what I was studying in school. I don't get the idea. But I've really tried." Because unless we make an effort to let people know that appearance alone is not the criteria by which you judge them, they will start to internalize it. And we know this. More for girls, but for girls and boys. Not that you shouldn't want to look your best or whatever the cliche is that you can absorb and offer back out, but boy, we overdo it. To a remarkable degree, this relentless pressure to look a certain way, to wear certain clothes, to appear well. But remember, appear. And how you appear and how you are, those are different. When God chooses David to be king, Samuel is about to pick his older brother, but God says to him, "Don't choose him. I've rejected him because I don't pay attention to how people look. Adonai yir'eh lalevav." God looks into the heart. In fact, I will tell you something astonishing that you probably don't know. The rabbis of the Talmud tell a story about Moses' appearance, and they say that Moses was ugly. Now, my guess is, if you asked any of us to describe Moses, none of us would say, "He was ugly." But think of what a profound point that is. Here is the greatest figure in the history of our tradition, and the rabbis explicitly say, he wasn't tall and handsome. But it didn't matter, because God didn't judge him by appearances. And we shouldn't either. As difficult as that is, we have to see it, appreciate it for what it is. And as you may know, when you see something beautiful or a beautiful person, there's a blessing you're supposed to say, because it is a reflection of God's creation in this world, which puts it into perspective. So you can appreciate beauty, you can try to look your best, But is that how you should judge yourself, ultimately? No. There are other ways. So let's move to another way that we judge ourselves. This also won't shock you. By what we have. In Judaism, I want to emphasize this. Poverty is not a judgment on character. It's just not. Nowhere in the Jewish tradition does it say, if you don't have money, you're not a good person. And conversely, nowhere in the Jewish tradition does it say, if you have a lot of money, you're obviously good. Not only because the Jewish tradition doesn't value that as the ultimate judge of character, but also because we know this. To judge somebody by the car they drive or the house they live in is like judging dinner by the appearance of the oven. It doesn't matter what it looks like from outside, it's the ingredients that matter. And yet, we are programmed, especially here, especially in this world, especially in Los Angeles, to assume that the beautiful and the rich equal the good. And beautiful and rich are different categories from good. A beautiful person is a beautiful person. A rich person is a rich person. And a good person can be both, one or neither. So it doesn't make sense to judge the way that we normally judge, or the third way that we normally judge, which is by distinguishing ourselves from the other people who aren't like us. We do this relentlessly. We're always distinguishing ourselves to make ourselves feel better. Sometimes we do it, let me give you an example. I have reached the age, as some of you have, when one of the things that I read in the newspaper is the obituaries. And I do it in part to find out who is alive that I didn't know now that they've died. Right? Every now and then you'll see like a sports figure or a figure from theater or acting or whatever, and you'll go, my God, I didn't know that that person was still alive now that they've died, I know. But the other reason you do it is because that way you can distinguish yourself. So-and-so died, but he had a chronic heart condition. I don't have a chronic heart condition, I'm okay. You look for whatever it is in the obituary that allows you to distinguish yourself from the bad fate of the other person. And we do that in life too. When someone does something that we disapprove of, we distinguish ourselves, we don't do that, therefore we are better. And so we get factions and groups and distinctions and judgment. Now, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. If I said to you, should you judge people by what they have, we'd all say, no, you shouldn't. Should you judge people by how they look? No, you shouldn't. Should you judge people by whether they're exactly like you or different? We would all give the same answer, even though we all, and I certainly include myself in this category, fall into that trap. But one of the reasons that we do is we don't have an alternative standard. How are you supposed to judge people, after all? Once you've taken away what they have and what they look like and whether they're like you, what are you left with? So here's the story. So as you know, I was asked, would I give the benediction for the Democratic National Convention? I said, of course. Any national convention that asks me, I'm there. Democrat, Republican, Independent. Do the independents have a convention? I can't imagine. So I went. It was an interesting experience. That's a subject for another time. Things about it that were good, things about it that were not so good. But they came up to me that day and they said, listen, we've had a little bit of a change in the schedule. If you don't mind, we're going to have you do the benediction after the roll call. I said, sure. What do I care? What do I know from the roll call? Do the roll call, then I'll do the benediction. It's great, I'll get to hear the roll call, whatever that is. What I did not know, but you obviously do, is that the roll call means the state delegation is going to vote to nominate, in this case, the president, and then they are going to leave. Because why should they stay once they did what they have come to Charlotte, North Carolina, of all places, to do? And so I stood there at the beginning of the roll call, and there was a stadium, a convention center of, I don't know, 15,000 people. And delegation by delegation by delegation, they voted and left. First of all, you have no idea how many states there are. Honest to God, it was like, I kept praying for the states to end already. And we were only at Illinois. And there was this guy sitting there with a big board of all the states, and as the state would go, he would check them off. And even the people, even the operatives backstage started to feel bad for me. Really, Rabbi, only 12 more states, and then you're on. Don't worry, you'll be okay. Some states, by the way, were more painful than others. When I saw Pennsylvania leave, having grown up, having been born in Harrisburg, which is the capital, and grown up in Philadelphia, I wanted to say to them, really, you couldn't stay? But let me tell you, by the time I gave my benediction, my guess is they were already drunk. That's how long it was between Pennsylvania and Wyoming. But here's why I'm telling you this. This is what happened. I was standing in the wings watching the final states march off to the pub. And Mayor Villaraigosa, who had to introduce me, had to stay too. So he's looking through these various papers as they're all leaving. And as it's getting to the end, I walked up to his son, who was standing behind him in the wings, and I said to him, you know, by the time I get to do the benediction, I'm going to be speaking to the empty chairs and the maintenance staff. And he said, and God. It changed the way I felt about that moment and many moments since in a second, in an instant, because I realized that all I had been thinking about was, are there going to be people sitting there to hear my prayer when it was supposed to be a prayer? And he was right. And all of a sudden, I didn't care, because I remembered that I was supposed to be giving a prayer, and that the prayer ultimately wasn't going to be judged by the delegation from Iowa, but by God. And that if I did right by God, it didn't matter if no one else heard it. And that's when I thought about today. All of Yom Kippur is trying to tell us we judge ourselves in so many trivial, fleeting things. We constantly live inside the minds of other people. What does this person think of me? What does that person think of me? I won't be okay unless their opinion of me changes. And we don't ask ourselves, how do we appear to God? Because ultimately, that question is a way of saying, are we living up to what it is we are supposed to be? Is the prayer we're offering, the things we do, the way we act, is that the way God would want us to act? And that's the only judgment ultimately that should matter to us. In our tradition, we don't hold up anyone as a model that you should always emulate. No Jewish parent ever tells their kid, you have to act just like Moses. We don't say, what would Moses do? We say, what should I do? You know that famous story about the Hasidic Rabbi Zusya, who when he's dying, he begins to cry, and his disciple says, why are you crying? And he says, because I know what God's going to say to me. I'm going to get to heaven, and God's not going to say to me, Zusya, why weren't you like Moses? Because Moses was the great Moses, he was a great prophet and lawgiver, and I'm not that. And he's not going to even say to me, why weren't you like Maimonides? Because Maimonides was this towering intellect and a wonderful philosopher, and I'm not that. But I know what God is going to say. God's going to say, Zusia, why weren't you Zusia? And then he said, I don't know what I'll answer. Now there was somebody who had a standard of judgment. So I want to leave you with a little story and a question that I thought of the moment that Antonio Jr. said to me, God, right away, I thought of this wonderful Hasidic story about Rabbi Bunim of Tzicha, who was in discussions with a non-Jew whom he happened to meet on the road, and they were talking about this and that, and finally, the man said to him, I just have one question for you, Rabbi. And he said, what? And he said, who do you work for? And Rabbi Bunim said, you know, I will pay you a salary if you will follow me around and every now and then just ask me that question, because it is so easy to forget. So, on this Yom Kippur, I ask you, who do you work for? Who do you act for? Who do you measure yourself for? What do you want to hold yourself to? When you think of who you want to be, whose choice is it? Inside yourself, is it someone else's or is it yours? How high are your standards? A man came up to Heschel once and said exactly what the man said at the joke at the beginning. He said, you know what? I don't really need God. I'm basically a good person. I'm kind to people. I care for those close to me. What do I need God for? And Heschel, the great Jewish theologian, pious man, learned man, said, I'm delighted to hear it about you. I wish I could say it about myself. All I know is I keep saying the wrong thing. I keep hurting people inadvertently. I keep not living up to who I should be. I need God. One person knew who they worked for. So, when I ask, who do you work for? I know God doesn't sign the checks. But ultimately, the work is in our souls. And I hope that you feel, in this coming year, that you've done your job, that you've been judged by the one who really should judge, and that that has given you freedom, because it does, from the opinions of others, and even some time from that carping voice in your head that tells you the way you have to look and what you have to have and what you have to do. All God wants of us is to be the best that we ought to be, not in our careers, not in our possessions, but in our souls. This year, judge right and be blessed. Gemar Chatimah Tovah.